Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. Grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. And if you want to try out caving or cave exploration, you'll want to get to know members of your local grotto. They can take you on a trip or two to find out if you like it or not. And more importantly, they'll help you do it right. So often, inexperienced people enter caves and run into trouble when their lights go bad or when they get lost or hurt. It's so easy for any of those things to happen, and organized caving has worked hard to come up with best practices to prevent those problems. Learn them, live them. You can find the nearest local grotto at the NSS website, caves.org. Easy to remember. Speaking of what happens when things go wrong, my guest this month is former National Coordinator of the National Cave Rescue Commission, Don Paquette. He was also the first Central Region Coordinator of the NCRC. We'll talk about how he got that job. Pretty good story. And we'll talk about various rescues he's been on. More on Don in a minute. If you follow the caving world, or certainly if you listen to this podcast, you know that Swegos are back. Swego was my first sponsor, and Scott came to me when he wasn't making packs, back when he ran into a supply problem with the old material, and therefore he wasn't even making any money, but he still wanted to help promote and support the podcast, and I'll never forget that. But now he's found a new supplier, new material, and it's even better than before. You can get all three sizes of the best caving pack ever made, the 740 cubic inch push pack, founder Scott McRae's go-to, even on long survey trips, or the 950 cubic inch pit pack, or the monster 1200 cubic inch sink pack. Swego packs are waterproof, abrasion resistant, simple in design, and even make for great flotation devices, as anyone who owns one knows all too well. Order from trusted retailers like Intermountain Outfitters or direct at swegogear.com. That's swegogear.com. I took a great caving trip last month. I took my sister-in-law and a co-worker to Wayne Cave, which is known for its quarter-mile-long crawlway. If you're a regular listener of the podcast, you've heard a lot about Wayne Cave. Because of the crawlway and a lot of other challenging sections, any trip in Wayne is a good one to kind of graduate your friends into a realm of more serious caving. I've taken my coworker and my sister-in-law on several trips, and I thought, you know what, we're working up to Wayne. So we took a classic trip to the RPI Passage, which is a formation-filled passage that ends in a really cool room called the Candles Room, these gorgeous translucent stalagmites that look like those tall cake candles you can buy. We had a few route-finding issues that put us close to overdue on the trip, but we made it out, plenty of daylight to spare, and all had a great time. Okay. Don Paquette, cave rescue expert, former national coordinator for the NCRC, former executive vice president of the NSS, Navy veteran. The guy worked on a nuclear submarine. We'll talk about that. He's thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail. We talk about that. But mostly we talk about his caving life, the troubled genesis of the now very well-respected NCRC, plus cave rescues he's been on, and a lot more. So let's get to it. Here's Don Paquette. What is your current title with the NCRC? Or do you have one? Or do you even care to go into titles?
Currently, I'm an instructor.
An instructor?
Just an instructor, yeah.
Yeah. But you used to be the national coordinator, right?
I was national coordinator from 1984 until 1992. And I was central region coordinator from the beginning, 1978 to 1984. And then again from 1992 till 1994, and that's when I resigned because I was going to take a year off and hike the Appalachian Trail.
Ah.
And I thought it was time to get new blood. I'm a big believer that organizations grow and don't stagnate when you bring in new people and keep people rotating and moving around, and so I thought it was time for somebody new.
I would have to agree with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go back to an unrelated note. Did you hike the Appalachian Trail?
Yes, I did.
The whole thing?
Yes.
Seasonal?
No. Thru-hiked it in 1 year, 1995.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, I know we're not talking about caving right now, but that's always been on my list.
It was the hardest thing I ever did.
Yeah?
Psychologically.
Okay. I would imagine.
And it was tough physically. It was not what I thought it was going to be when I decided I wanted to do it.
In what way?
In that it was like a job. I thought I'd be backpacking for a year, but no, it was, yeah, I backpacked for about 2 weeks. And then you have to get up, you have to put the pack on, you have to walk, because if you don't, you're not going to make your next food drop.
That's your job, yeah.
And so it becomes your job. Whether you want to or not, you've got to hike.
And I'm sure that at certain points it just wasn't fun.
Exactly. I mean, it was hard work, but rewarding. I mean, when you stand on top of some of those mountains and catch some of the views and the people, I met some really, really neat people. And I was so impressed with the younger kids that were hiking. It was hard. It was fun.
Somebody give you a trail name?
My trail name was Spelio.
Spelio. How perfect. How apropos.
Exactly.
Did any of your rescue training come into that at all? Did you ever run across anybody who was in trouble, or did you yourself get in trouble?
Not really. I took a header off of a mountain in the White Mountains.
New Hampshire?
Yeah, New Hampshire. Mm. It just came out, I think, the Madison Shelter, and I was on my way down to a road crossing. I was going to hitchhike into Gorham and spend the night in a hostel and get a shower. And I was hiking with these 30-somethings or 20-somethings, because I was a 40-something, late 40-something. Basically, I'll say hike with them. I'd see them in the morning and I'd see them at night, and they were gone, and they had all taken off. And I was hiking alone. And up there, the tundra is really fragile, and they have signs that please stay on the marked trail. But the problem is finding the marked trail is not easy. Sometimes it's difficult. And I was standing on a ledge. It was about 3 feet down, and trying to see where the trail went. I don't know if the rock broke or my foot just slipped or something, but anyway, one leg went down 3 feet, and I fell into it and over the 3-foot drop and hit. And I remember as I was going down, the thought that went through my head is, I hope whatever breaks isn't vital.
And it's amazing that you have the amount of time to think that.
To think that. But that was my thought. I hope whatever breaks isn't vital. Because I was by myself, and I was probably a mile or two down from the hut, but I was still about probably 10 miles from the road crossing. And by myself, and I knew I was the last hiker of the day, and it was cold up there. This was, getting into late September, early October.
So you were hiking north, yeah.
Yeah, hiking north. It was in September, but yeah. In the White Mountains, it's cold. I mean,
But nothing broke.
Cold. Well, I hit, and I laid there flat out, flat on my back, and I started wiggling toes and wiggling hands and wiggling legs, and everything operated, and everything felt good, and I just kind of did a quick pat around to make sure, and I put my hand on my head, and it was wet.
Uh-oh.
I was wearing a bandana, like a do-rag.
Yeah.
And I pulled it off, and it was a green bandana, only it was bright red.
Oh, no.
And I'm thinking, oh, man, this is bad. And I put pressure on it. But head injuries bleed a lot.
Yeah, a lot of blood up there.
A lot of blood up there. But anyway, I said, okay, and I got up, and I, got my pack on, and I said, okay, I'm let's not mess around. Let's go. It's downhill all the way. And so I took my time, and I got down, and as soon as I got, and it was probably about 2 hours later, 2 or 3 hours later, I got to a place where I could camp. It was a platform, because designated camping in the White Mountains.
Yeah.
As soon as I got there, I dug into my pack, and I pulled out my first aid kit, or my personal bag, because I had a mirror in there so I could shave. And I took the mirror, and I held it up, and took a little flashlight, and I shined it in my eyes, and I said, okay, both pupils are the same.
Well, all right.
So this is a good thing. Now, if they had not been, I don't know what would have been the problem. But anyhow, this told me it was a good thing. And by that time, the bleeding had stopped. And so it was fine. And I said, well, I think I'll go to bed. I didn't take any pain relievers or anything, but nothing hurt that bad. And it was a funny thing is when I got into the hostel the next day, I was really, man, I really hurt myself, blah, blah. And I got in there and every one of those 20-somethings. One of them had a sprained wrist. One of them had a sprained ankle.
Oh, my.
They had crashed and burned going down the mountain.
Everybody got
everybody
hurt.
Got clobbered on that hike.
Well, that must have been a pad to your ego.
Oh, it was. So anyhow, I think that was the only first aid that I had to do on the whole trail that I remember.
Oh,
so
man.
It was
Well, you were fun. You were also
You also worked on a nuclear submarine, right?
Yes.
What was your job?
I was reactor operator.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I was reactor operator.
You're in the back.
Yes, I was, yeah.
So so here's the question I've been wanting to ask you, Don, about that. Yeah. Do you think that any of your caver instincts went into that, being sort of in this, you know, you're underwater, there's no light, you know, coming from the sun, it's somewhat cramped quarters. I mean, was that luck of the draw, or was that something that you kind of had your eye on, thinking I could do that job, I could work on a submarine, nuclear submarine, because I have this this sort of penchant for caves?
There's a history to that, to get into it. I've always been kind of an adventurous person, for one thing. The Thresher went down in 63, and I was in high school.
Thresher submarine, yeah.
Thresher submarine, and to me, it was sad, but it was an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So I got fascinated by submarines at that time, and I read a lot about what I could find on them, and it wasn't because of caving, mm-hmm. I don't think it's, well, I love going caving, and I like tight spaces, but I'm comfortable there.
Yeah, you have a mind that mm-hmm. allows that, whereas a lot of people, the idea of being in a submarine mm-hmm. or even in a cave is terrifying.
Yeah, and it could be that, but anyhow, Art and Dave Gayheimer are a couple of cavers mm-hmm. that I met when I was in high school, and we opened up Queen Blair.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah,
just
okay.
Just over the hill.
It was Art, Dave, and Dick and I opened that up. We did a lot of work on the crawlway to break in.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave was an electronics technician on the Abraham Lincoln, which was a FBM submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was home on leave when I met him. And he would come home on leave and go caving. He would tell me stories about being on a submarine and the adventure of it. And I was kind of fascinated with it anyway. So when Indiana University offered me the chance for an all-expense-paid trip to Southeast Asia because my grades were so stellar, back in the 60s, I had a buddy that said the same thing happened at Purdue, and we joined the Navy and volunteered to go on submarines. And they told us at the time, if you go to nuclear power school, you have to extend for 2 years because it is a very expensive school, and they want to get their money's worth out of it. And I didn't care. I mean, at that point in time, I was 19 years old. I just wanted to get the hell out of Bloomington and go and do something. No problem. And so I joined the Navy and volunteered. You know, I took all the tests, and I was selected for nuclear power school. So I said, well, that'll get me on a submarine. And that's how it happened, you know, because I wanted to go on a submarine. And it turned out it wasn't really the caving similarity there. I mean, a submarine is a workaholic's dream.
Plenty to do.
Oh, there is more to do than you can get done. And, you know, the tight spaces never really bothered me that much. And that could be part of the caving background that I had, you know, because I'd been caver for years and years before this happened. That's what led to it.
So how long was that then? Did you do the 2 years and then some, or was it just the 2 years and stop?
Well,
the 2 years extra.
I did the two and got out. I extended a little bit because my wife at the time was pregnant, and the chief CNO of the Navy was Admiral Zumwalt, and he said, okay, if you're due to get out and you have a pregnant wife, you can extend your enlistment until the baby's born.
All right.
And that's a deal.
Yeah.
That was a financial windfall.
Count me in because
it was there. And my son was born Christmas Day in 1972, and I got out January 2nd, 1973.
Oh, my word. Yeah. Well, let's go back to high school and the caving life and the genesis of the caving life.
Yeah.
So what was your first cave?
My first cave was Ruby Falls.
Oh, Tennessee.
In 1952.
Was this a tourist
trip? 5 years old.
Okay.
And I was totally, totally fascinated by it.
And that was it?
And that I was hooked at that point.
Huh.
Now, we didn't live in Bloomington. I was born in Kankakee, Illinois, and we lived in Kankakee, which is up north. But as soon as I learned the letters CAVE on road signs, my father regretted ever taking me to Ruby Falls. Because
hey,
when we were on a trip and I would see cave, let's go, you know. But there are no wild caves in northern Illinois.
Yeah.
when I think I was in the third grade, we moved to Decatur, Illinois, in the central part of the state. Once again, no caves. We found a couple of things we called caves because they were trees growing out of banks, and the roots would go down over the bank, and we could crawl in behind them and stuff. And,
yeah.
And that was our cave. But we moved to Bloomington in 1960. I was 13 years old. We lived in town for a while, and then we moved out to Highland Village on the west side of Bloomington. And
did you know that there were caves all over?
I found out there were caves.
Okay.
You know, shortly after I got there, there were wild caves. I didn't know where they were and stuff. But then after we moved to Highland Village, I'm out running around in the woods. I mean, it was different than it is today. I mean, 37 was two lanes going north out of town. And where Otis Elevator was Campbell's Farm. And we would run up and go back there, and there was a Twin Lakes sports complex on 2nd Street was actually a lake, two lakes. and if you go on the back side of them, there's a waterfall. Well, we used to hike in from Highland Village through we'd go through Campbell's Farm, where Otis is now, and hike back through the woods, and bang, found a cave.
There it was. Do you know which one it was?
No, it's gone now. It's probably in the middle of 37, just on a little bit south of the railroad underpass.
So progress destroyed that cave.
Oh, it took it out. Yeah, for sure. But it was probably maybe 3 feet high, 8 feet wide, and went back about 20 feet. Just a shelter cave, nothing in it at all. And we'd go there and play and just hike through and explore it. And I'm a big believer in one of my philosophical ideas. People who grow up with caves in their backyard approach caving differently from people who don't.
In what way?
It's just a natural thing. It's not something we plan for. You know, when you live in Indianapolis, you're going to go caving. You got to plan a trip. You got to get your stuff together. You got to go, and that kind of thing. When you're living down there, you have a flashlight and you just go, you know. And we'd ride our bicycles down to Leonard Springs Road. There's a small maze cave. It's a joint control cave just off Leonard Springs Road. We'd ride our bicycles down there and go up in the cave and smoke cigarettes, you know, because we're out of sight. We're kids. We're 14, 15 years old. But that was what caving was to us.
Yeah.
And we weren't really interested in caving and safety and conservation and hard hats. What's that? You know, nobody knew what a hard hat was. It took a flashlight. Just go in a cave, yeah. My first trip to Buckner's.
Which was probably
1963.
All right, yeah, just a couple of years after.
Just right after Dick bought the property.
Yeah.
And one of my friends had gone to it on a Boy Scout campery, so he knew where it was. But they had camped near Wayne's Cave on Gardner Road in some farmer's field, so that's how we knew how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So we parked over by Wayne's and walked back through the woods to get to Buckner's. And my first trip through Buckner's, three of us, one flashlight. Well, we had the ratios right. Well,
you had three guys, but what'd you do? What'd you do? Did you do the circle or did you?
No, we didn't do this complete circle route, but we got to the volcano.
Well, all right. So that was the classic spelunker route.
Yeah, it was a spelunker route. But then we started thinking that there's got to be a circle route because there was a lot of graffiti then, but there was some, and there were arrows pointing both ways.
Right, right, right.
Right about that area. And we said, this thing makes a circle.
You didn't have a map.
We didn't have a map.
Yeah.
In fact, was there
a map at that time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but we went to, we went back a few times and maybe got a few more lights. You know, there'd be five of us and four lights, you know,
okay.
Something like that.
Well, we're making progress.
We're making some progress. And and we found our way around the circle route. And so we went back and said, okay, we got to draw a map of this thing. We didn't know anything about survey. We didn't know anything, but we knew we could draw a map of the thing.
For your own use.
Yeah. I mean, we were curious about the thing. We needed to see a map and I told my dad, I said, there's a lot of passage back there. No, there isn't. You know, So anyhow, we went back and we had paper and pencil. I don't even think we had a tape. We might have had a tape with us. I'm not sure, but anyway, we're going to map the cave. And so we're hiking in from Gardner Road and we get down to the entrance and there's this guy with a shovel, and he's burying electrical wire.
All right.
And So we come up, and he says, hi. Yeah, he says, yeah, my name's Dick Blends. I own this cave. Would you like a map?
What was he burying electrical wire for?
Okay, we were trying to get some electricity down into the entrance room of Buckner's. There was a guy named Lawton from northern Indiana we were digging at the back of the entrance room.
Okay, yeah.
Digging on top of the breakdown because there's a rumor that there's some Civil War stuff that might be buried back there.
Fair enough.
You know, and
I could believe
around.
It.
You know, rumors will get you a lot of free labor. A lot of theories will get you free labor. So anyway, that was, and I spent a lot of time at the top of that breakdown pile kipping rocks and hauling rocks and stuff. But I don't remember if he was doing it to get lights down there or something, but he was in, he had an electric pole, basically where the trail starts now from behind the shelter on down. And
it's just so funny, yeah. you'd say that because that just sounds like Dick.
Yeah,
you know what
and,
I mean.
And that's what he was doing at the time. You know, yeah.
like you here, you know, head on in. Here's the map. That's
and,
great.
Yeah, and we had, you know, the electric power was there. Now, the barn was there. We hadn't set up the field house part of it yet. There was no concrete floor or anything. But he said, "Hey, you guys want to go? You know, get your car and park it here and stuff." And so I learned about the barn. And all of a sudden, it was like I was there. This is Mecca.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 13 years old. I'm fascinated by caves, and here are real cavers.
Yeah. And here's a guy who owns the property,
who wants people
to come hang out.
Just says, come on out, and that kind of thing. And people were coming down from all areas and stuff, and camping there on the weekends, and there was a lot of parties. You know, it was a fun place to be.
Sure, sure.
And it was basically what I call the Facebook of the day.
Yeah.
You know, it was Facebook. That's where stuff got planned. That's where stuff happened.
It was real life.
Yeah, and so that's what the barn was at that point.
Yeah, can I just say that your write-up on the barn, before I ever met or talked to you, I read your article that was, I don't know if you wrote it for the 07 National Convention or what.
It was for the guidebook.
I loved that thing on the barn. I mean, and the barn's been gone for 30 years now.
Yeah.
You know, and recently they've got a great shelter there. But, I've been going to Buckner since before the shelter was built and all that, you know, but not that long. But I loved the romance of that period that you put into that article. It just sounded like the greatest time. Bunch of cavers hanging out.
Oh, it was.
You know, a lot of people cut their teeth there.
Oh, exactly. I think there's a lot of people who probably wouldn't be cavers today.
No.
Had it not been for that.
Buckner is world famous and
place.
and infamous to a degree, but so is the barn.
Oh yeah.
I've met people when people friends of mine will say this guy crawls around in caves, and then there's one or two older guys who are like, I've been in a cave before, and 9 times out of 10 it was Buckner. And they remember the cave, they remember the barn, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So when did the rescue thing come in?
Okay. I was interested in rescue early on. My first cave rescue was a non-rescue. It was we're out at the barn, and it's Sunday afternoon. Dick's getting ready to close the place up and head back to Griffith because he hadn't moved to Bloomington yet. I think it was probably 63 or 64, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And there was a blue Mustang that had been sitting parked all weekend. Just sitting there. And it was the only car that was left except for the locals, like mine and a couple other people that were there, like Larry Townsend and maybe two or three other people. And Dick came up and he says, we're mounting a rescue. What? He says, yes, this car has been here all weekend and we don't know where these people are, so we're going to go search Buckner's. And so anyhow, we take off, and Larry Townsend and I got the assignment to go to the waterfall. And then we were all going to meet at the volcano and decide from that point on what we were going to do. But that was our objective. Okay, let's go in, quick search, hasty, check all this stuff out, get back there, regroup, and then come up with the next step. And so we did. I mean, Larry and I just blasted all the way to the waterfall. We got back there, didn't see a sign of anybody. Came back, got to the volcano, and there's a bunch of people sitting around. And people had gone to the left, gone to the right, and got back there. And so we're kind of coming up with what's the next plan. And somebody said, who are we looking for? And we said, the people in the blue Mustang. They said, oh, that's us. And we go, what? Yeah, well, somebody said, right before we went in, somebody put a note on the window, rescue, search going on in Buckner, and stuck it under their windshield wiper, and they, away we went. They got back. They had gone with some other people down to Blue Spring with a canoe and spent, you know, this all day Sunday in Blue Spring, canoeing around in Blue Spring, and came back. And they got dropped off there to their car. They saw the note. Said, oh, okay, we'll go help.
We'll go.
And bam, they came in the cave.
Not enough information.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've done OCR, and the one thing that rescuers need is information.
It's information, yeah.
And not
yeah.
enough information yeah. was provided yeah. to those rescuers.
The great information vacuum, and there it was. So anyhow, that was where I kind of got started. Probably the other thing that really drove me into being interested in rescue and rescue preparedness, I took a header in Freeman's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Freeman Pit, just so you know, if you're not familiar, is near 100-foot pit, about the edge of the county. It is at the edge of the county. But it's in Monroe County, same county as Buckner.
Yeah, it's in Whitehall. It's right in the county. And back in those days, okay, and this is, I'm still in high school, my vertical training, I'm self-taught. It's like a lot of things. When I've decided I wanted to do something, I try to figure out how to do it. Probably on my first big adventures, I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I was really got into parachutes. And so anyway, my mom had torn up a sheet, and I found half of a bed sheet and some twine. And I tied the twine to the four corners and tied it off to my belt and climbed up on our garage roof in the backyard and jumped off. It didn't work.
No, it doesn't sound like it would.
But I survived.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of my background and how things develop. I learned the hard way on stuff a lot of times. So anyway, I learned how to rappel by watching people at the barn.
Okay, yeah.
And I managed to get my hands on 150 feet of goal line. And had some brake bars and a set harness that buckled. It was just a piece of webbing that would go around and buckle. And, you know, if the rivets would have popped out of it, I would have been launched right then.
Oh, boy.
And the carabiners were steel ovals.
This is brake bars and beaners.
Yeah, beaners and bars. Yeah. And the particular brake bars I had were some I'd bought on a vacation out in California at a climbing shop, which were cast steel that had a hole in one side and came across about a quarter of an inch in diameter and then a roll pin coming up to bounce against the gate.
Okay.
And I had two of those and a chain link between them and a Casson D oval on the sit harness. And to climb out, what I did was I looked at the REI catalog and they had a picture of the amazing Swiss rope climbing device called the Jumar Ascender.
Yeah.
And it showed the guy with two ascenders right up on his neck and two ropes coming down to his feet. And it wasn't Mitchell. It was just, you know, one leg was going to work hard and the other was just going to drag behind it. I couldn't afford the Jumars. They were $13.50 a piece.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah. So I was using 3/8 Manila Prusik knots.
Yeah, Prusik. Okay.
And I used two of them to replace the Jumars.
Sure. That's a system.
It's a system, okay? And I didn't know about the 3-knot Prusik system or anything like that. I mean, that's how I... Okay, that'll work. So Ned Caldwell and I and a couple other people went over to Freeman's, and we shared gear. I had the gear. I had the rope. I rappelled in, and, you know, they pulled my gear up, and Ned put it on, and he rappelled in, and then we get to the bottom, and Ned says, I've never Prusik before.
Oh, great.
I said, well, I thought you did shaft. He says, yeah, but I did on a cable ladder. So so I got him rigged up into Prusiks, and he climbed out. And the other thing to remember, Freeman's pit entrance at that time, if you've seen Freeman's now, it's a big sinkhole.
Yeah.
Okay, back then, the entrance to Freeman's pit was 8 feet long, 3 feet wide rectangle.
Interesting. What happened? Am I about to find out?
Well, that's the entrance, but there was a chimney that went off to one side that went all the way to the surface.
Okay.
Okay, but it was basically body size, and it came down to a ledge that was about probably 5 or 6 feet below the lip.
Okay.
Or the pit, and the lip was a sharp 90. I mean, just bang, bang, 90.
Yeah.
And the tree to rig was right there. And all that now is all eroded away into the sinkhole that mm-hmm. we have now, okay? But so anyway, I got my knots on, and I started climbing, and I got to the top. And while I was down there, one of the guys who were with it didn't come down the pit, had climbed down to that ledge through the chimney, and he was sitting on that ledge for a while, and he climbed back out. And so I got to the top, and I'd come up pretty fast because I was a little chilly by the time I started climbing, and I swung over on that ledge and sat down to rest a minute before I negotiated this 90-degree lip with 2 Prusik knots, okay?
Oh,
figure this is going to be fun, right? And I looked up behind me, and I said, man, I can just climb out of here.
Oh, no.
And so I lifted up one of my legs to take the sling off of it, and I slipped off the ledge.
Oh.
Which was cool.
Yeah, you're roped in.
Well, as I'm spinning around, I'm seeing the wall of the pit come for me, and I kicked my leg straight out in front of me and grabbed a hold of the rope to push off and did not realize it at the time, but I grabbed both knots.
You just slid right down.
I think it was probably 8 seconds later I hit bottom.
Oh, my God.
And so I'm laying there, and once again I start doing the body check, wiggling stuff. Everything worked.
No.
And my hard hat was like, I had a hard hat by then. It was Army Surplus World War II helmet liner.
Okay.
Okay.
With
a chin strap.
Okay.
But it was on one side of the pit. My carbide light was over on the other side of the pit. And so I got up and I walked around. Okay, everything works. Put it back together. Well, you know, two of them had taken off to go get help. I was the only one that drove. I know I was 16 then. I had the car. Nobody else could drive. And I said, well, call them back because I think I can get out. Because my whole thing in my mind was get out of here.
Yeah, just get
now.
Out. Just get out.
Just get out. And because about a month before, on a Boy Scout thing, we had toured the fire departments. And I asked them, I said, what do you do if somebody's lost in a cave? Oh, we can get them out. I said, well, what about a pit? Oh, we got plenty of ladders. And that went through my mind, and I said, there's nobody here that really knows how to get me out of here that I knew of at the time. There were cavers there that could have done it, but I didn't know them at that time. And so anyway, I got stuff on, and I climbed. And I got to the top. They helped me over the top, and I stood up and blab. Couldn't walk. Everything's kind of stoved up. So we get back to my car, and they help me, you know, back to the car. Nobody could drive a stick shift but me.
Oh, great. So you had to drive.
So I had to drive. And I drove home, and my parents were home. My old man, he was not happy with me caving anyway. And he was livid. He was livid. So they took me into the hospital, and they did some x-rays, and they said, well, you basically have just sprained everything, and you tore your left kidney open.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that was the initial. He says, go home, hot baths and Epsom salts, and that'll work. So
wow.
I went home and got in a bathtub, and I could hardly move. My old man turned the water on full hot, dumped in a bunch of Epsom salts, and walked out. As I was just scalding, I had to reach up and get that thing. That happened, I think it was on a Tuesday afternoon, because it was summertime.
Yeah.
And the next Monday, I went to Sullivan's. Probably the best thing I could do.
What was that trip? What did you do in Sullivan? It had to have been an easy trip. You were probably still hurting.
Yeah, well, it went to the spiral room.
Okay.
The spiral room and back out. And that was it, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You really did have the bug. Like, if I got hurt that bad in a cave, I think I'd be like, all right, no more caving for a couple of months.
Well,
I don't know.
2 weeks later, I said, I don't know how I'm going to handle a vertical situation. And so, all by myself, I feel like I'm in a confessional here, Father Matt.
That's the vibe I try to give out. Tell me your sins.
I went to Shaft by myself and did it twice.
Oh, goodness gracious. No, this was just the pit and then back out and then,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I just bounced it twice.
Just bounced the shaft
just
pit twice.
Bounced the pit.
75 feet or so.
75 feet, but that first rappel was really a trip.
You just what was it? Was it just you needed to prove something, or you just wanted to go caving?
I wanted to find out if I could do it.
Okay.
I mean, I had just taken an 85, probably a 90-foot header, you know, out of control, and you know, there's something psychological about that after, you know, after it happens. So, but anyway, that developed an interest in rescue.
Okay. Yeah. So So when you talk to the firefighters, yeah, they're like, we have plenty of ladders.
Yeah.
And you realize, okay, they don't know what the hell they're doing.
They have no clue that there's even a 100-foot pit out there, probably. You know,
no.
At this time, you know, and the cavers, and so I was talking to Blends, because you know, we were still going out to the barn and hanging around and campfires, and I would bring up rescue and preparedness. And basically the philosophy with the old-timers at that point in time was, if we have an accident in a cave, if they aren't killed instantly, they're probably going to live long enough for us to figure out a way to get them out.
All right, yeah. That's a little grim.
But that was the thought.
Man.
And I'm thinking, you know, getting somebody out of a cave can be a lot tougher than maybe you think, you know. And we didn't really have any experience to fall back on. But anyhow, that was kind of the attitudes. And I would bring it up a lot. And I got poo-pooed a lot by the experienced old-timers. You know, it was just, we don't need to do this. It's a waste of time.
I wonder why.
Yep. That was the philosophy of the time, I think.
Well, it proved... It proved necessary, especially with the popularity of Buckner later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But that was the thinking. Now, I spent 6 years in the Navy, and the military aspect gave me some preparedness for that and thinking about, you know, being prepared for emergencies. I got to do a little stint in Vietnam in 68, and I got a little combat experience there. So anyway, I was thinking about that at the time. So I saw a article in the NSS News in 1978 by Dan Smith, and it was about a seminar to be held in Austin, Texas, for cave rescue.
78 was it?
1978.
That late?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that seems a little late.
Yeah, it was 5 years after I got. I've been out of the Navy for 5 years. We'd already had by that time the three kids down in Salamander.
Yeah.
Okay, that was in 76. And I was involved in the Salamander incident, pretty heavy.
Yikes.
And so I was still thinking about, you know, preparedness and what are we going to do if, you know, we got somebody that we need to put in a stretcher and haul them out of Wayne's or something like that, you
right,
know, or
right,
the back part of Sullivan's, you know. And but it couldn't really generate any interest in it. So Dan was talking about, in this article, the National Cave Rescue Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically training and preparedness is what the article's theme was on. And the seminar was based on that. Well, at that point in time, I couldn't get off work for that, but I did get to the 78 New Braunfels Convention, Texas Convention. And Dan gave a paper at the convention on the NCRC. And I went to it. I was interested in it. And Dan Smith is the kind of guy, he was a fire captain and a caver. I swear to God, he missed his calling by not selling used cars.
Yeah? He was that kind of guy?
He's that kind of guy. Okay, he is a salesman. But after his paper, I went up to him and I said, I'm very interested in, you know, what you're doing here. I said, who is your central region coordinator? Because I would like to meet him. He said, where do you live? And I said, Bloomington, Indiana. He smiled and he said, you are. That's one of those turning points of life. And so that's how I got involved with NCRC. So I'm one of the founders, in the fact I'm the first Central Region Coordinator.
Yeah.
We were just getting off the ground at that point in time. And so I went home and did the things I thought I was supposed to do, which was contact all the grottos and find out, you know, they had call down lists and who would be available for rescue and kind of push the training and that kind of stuff. And Dan sent me a letter and says, your real job is to be a fundraiser. You got to go out and raise $15,000 for the NCRC.
Good Lord.
I said, that ain't going to happen. No way.
So that didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. But I found out why is the fact that Dan was wanting to do a lot of training and go to a lot of seminars and stuff on the NSS's dime. And he had gone to, and I don't know what the details were, and I never did find out, and I really don't care at this point in time, but evidently he had gone to Europe to go to the International Cave Rescue Symposium in England in 78.
So at this point, overseas was ahead of us?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the
Hungarians. Way ahead of us.
Yeah, the Hungarians were kicking like crazy.
They had it. They had it down.
And the Cave Rescue Network in England with Dr. John Franklin and John Ayers were just, they a lot of experience doing rescues.
Yeah.
And recoveries. So they kind of had it down.
Nice.
And evidently he had gone over and billed the NSS for it. And the Board of Governors says, not going to happen, man. This is, you're out of your mind here. And we're killing the NCRC.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And so I went to the 79 seminar. I didn't get 78, but I got 79. And I told Dan, I had probably more rescue experience than most of the instructors by that time, except maybe Steve Hudson and maybe one other guy.
Actual rescues.
I had actual rescue experience. But I said, I really want to see how you conduct this class, and the best way for me to do that is to be a student. I said, I'd like to come to that seminar as a student. So I did. And I went in as the first time they had level two, because they didn't have level two with the first one. This was the second one, so they had level two for the retainees and level one. I went in as a level one student. Went through the seminar, met some, quite a few people. But backstory in that is when I got there, I had not met Steve Hudson. I'd heard about Steve, but I never met him. So I met Steve, and then I found out Lee, and also Lee Noon and some of the other coordinators found out about the fact we were going to lose NCRC.
Mm.
And so we had what I've referred to as the Albany coup.
Let's back up. When you say lose NCRC, you said that the NSS wanted to sort of disband it because they felt that they were sort of overstepping, or what?
Okay.
What was it that they wanted to kill?
Let's go a little more history here.
Okay, let's do it.
1965, Schroeder's Pants Cave, New York.
Okay, not heard of this.
Bill Mitchell. You've heard of the Mitchell Award?
The Mitchell Award?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, it's an award that's given to the best paper presented by a person under 25 years old in an NSS convention.
Okay, all right.
And
I've heard
it's in honor of Bill Mitchell, who died in Schroeder's Pants Cave in 1965.
Gotcha.
Okay. Bill Karras was a caver who formed the National Capital Grotto Rescue Squad.
Mm.
He was going to use Air Force Two to fly his squad all over the country and be drop out of the sky cave rescuers.
Okay. That sounds a little...
Okay. They went into the Mitchell thing in Schroeder's Pants, and basically he spent a lot of time in front of the TV cameras, and obviously they couldn't even do a body recovery out of this one. They blew the cave shut with Mitchell still hanging on a rope.
Yeah, what was it that happened?
He was climbing, and he got hung up on a rope in a waterfall, cold waterfall. He wasn't prepared for it.
Okay.
And probably died of hypothermia on the rope.
Wow.
Yeah. And the NSS was pretty embarrassed about that.
Wow, I'd imagine.
Okay. Exactly the same time. Well, not exactly the same time, but also in 1965, a guy from Indiana was out in a cave in Utah and got hung up and was rescued by a group of cavers and local fire guys working together, and they went in and got him out, and there was no publicity hardly at all on it.
Well, he didn't die.
Yeah, but the whole thing is that rescue went off without a hitch.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And the other one got a lot of bad publicity, and bad publicity about caves is always found upon by cavers. And so the buzz around the Annex 65 convention was, we don't like this.
We don't like any publicity.
Dropping out of the sky, super cave rescue team.
Right. And it attracts too much attention.
There was a lot of arrogance, too. I mean, I met Bill Karras, and he was kind of an arrogant guy.
Hmm.
Bill got mad at the NSS and decided to form the SSA, Speleological Society of America. I met him in Hannibal, Missouri in 1966, and he's trying to recruit people to join. Well, about that time, three kids from Hannibal disappeared and were never found. And some caves had been opened up in a road cut when they were putting in a new road. And bang, here comes Karras with the SSA.
Oh, gracious.
Okay.
He's going to find him.
Rescue squad. No.
No?
Spent all his time in front of the TV cameras talking it up that they were going to do it, and then why they couldn't do it. And the press did not distinguish between the NSS and the SSA.
Oh, God.
But the whole attitude of cavers about organized cave rescue was really down. You start talking rescue, and it was...
Among the NSS people.
You'd probably get a better response saying, I went into a cave and took a bunch of formations and nobody would have batted an eye. You start talking about rescue and they want to kill you. Seriously.
That's,
I mean,
it's crazy to me.
I mean, but the whole attitude was there, and a lot of it.
And they ended up generalizing all rescue people into that.
Yeah, with the arrogance and that whole thing.
Huh.
And when I took over as national coordinator, that's what I fought.
That idea that we're all arrogant?
I fought that philosophy. And you start talking rescue, and people just said, yeah, NCRC, stay away from those people. Seriously.
Man.
Yeah. But we're at grassroots, and we're trying to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and
you're not looking for attention. You're just trying to figure out how to do it. He was looking for attention.
Yeah, I think he was, you know, at that point in time. And he's gone now, so, you know, it's history. But we still had to fight that. And
man.
And then we had a lot of internal things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to back up to the coup, we rewrote the charter. Russ Rhodes wrote the charter. Wrote a new charter for us. And Steve and Lee Noon and I approached Dan, and we said, look, Dan was national coordinator at the time. You're going to have to do this or we're going to lose the NCRC.
Mm-hmm.
The board is just going to say, no, we're not going to have the NCRC. We're not going to support it. Okay.
Mm.
You become Western Regional Coordinator. Lee Noon is going to become National Coordinator. Chuck Hempel, who was doing some training in Virginia and the Eastern Region, but we had a philosophical wedge between us at that point in time. We said, well, rather than fight him, let's bring him in and maybe we can iron this out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a good theory. So we'll try this and see if Chuck will accept it, which turns out he did. And we're going to approach the board and see if they'll give us one more shot. And the second thing is this, all the money for the NCRC has to be handled through the NSS Treasury. They're just not going to let, you know, the people go out and spend money without going through all the procedures.
Right, right. Makes sense.
And so that's what we did, and Dan said, okay, I'll do it. I'll become, you know, Western Region Coordinator. The next week after the Albany seminar, which turned out to be a really good seminar, we rescued John Milroy from the cave. He was our mock victim.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And the convention was, in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Steve and I and probably Lee spent the whole week buying drinks for directors.
just
lobbying and lobbying
let's
and
iron
lobbying.
This out.
We
let's
talked it up and
over.
Talked it up and talked it up. And the new charter and so finally, I think the Friday afternoon board meeting, they said, okay, we'll give them one more year.
All right.
So we got our chance. You know, they gave us a year to see how it worked out, and if it worked out fine, then
yeah.
We could continue.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. We got in there. You know, so we went from there and basically just worked and continued to try to develop what we were doing. We had to figure out what we were going to do.
Yeah, of course.
One of the bigger problems is this: they do rescues differently in TAG than we do in Indiana. And they do in the Eastern region, and different problems in the Northwest, and different problems out West, and different problems in the Southwest. And so when you try to come up with a comprehensive curriculum that fits everybody in the country,
mm-hmm. It's probably not easy.
It's not easy, and it's basically, philosophically, it's a battle.
It's borderline impossible, it seems like.
It was. And I mean, we're trying to figure out curriculum for our seminars with 13 people and 13 very strong-willed alpha males
oh,
with big egos.
Yeah.
I'm right in there with them.
Yeah.
Because I know how we do it in Indiana, and by God, everybody ought to do it that way. But we don't have, you know, massive multi-drop pits, and we don't have, you know, a lot of sewer-type caves. And so anyhow, coming up with that, and we had some battles. I mean, it was just, you know, basically we would fight and fight and fight and never really come up with anything. And then we would finally get people to agree to do stuff, and we're all volunteers.
Yeah.
So you know how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. And then nothing happens, you know. And
boy, this is sounding familiar.
Yeah. And so we fought it and fought it. And finally, I was national coordinator, and I'm fighting this. And then the other problem we had was agency people were coming in, and they wanted more than a certificate of attendance.
Fair enough. They're wanting a certification.
They want or at least a certificate of completion.
Okay.
Okay, so they want to be certified. And the cavers didn't care. Cavers just want to learn some cool stuff that they could use when they're, you know, if they need to do a rescue.
Sure.
You know, and we're still trying to figure out the best way to do that and the best way to teach it. And we all have different teaching methods and that type of thing and philosophies. I'm driving home from a seminar and I'm thinking small group dynamics might do this.
Mm.
And then the other thing I was getting was who am I to certify you?
Mm-hmm.
Who certified me to certify you? And that was the big thing going through my head. And then what kind of records are we going to keep? Because if you're going to say somebody's certified, now you got to keep records.
Yeah.
You know? And so we're kind of fighting that battle. And I had gotten my pilot's license, and I was kind of studying, just reading about history of flight and that kind of thing. And it turns out that pilots, basically, Orville and Wilbur said, okay, we know how to fly airplanes, so we're going to become the instructors. Yeah, and then we'll teach them, and then they can become instructors. I had this epiphany. I said, well, wait. Okay. We'll just say we're the experts. Quote unquote experts. Now, there are no experts in cave rescue. I will say that. That's always been one of my guiding things. But I say, if you don't think we are good enough to certify you, prove it.
All right, there you go.
And so what we will do is we will take the people that have been doing the teaching for the most part of the seminars, okay, and we will just grandfather them as certified cave rescue instructors. And then to come up with the standards, instead of having 13 of us do this, let's have a small group do this. So let's create an education board. And the education board is responsible to get other people to write the lesson plans, but they should guide them, review them, and then give them to the board of coordinators for approval. But that's how we will get our curriculum developed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things the education board is going to do is come up with the certification criteria for instructors so that the instructors can recertify. So when you became a grandfathered instructor, it was good for 3 years. And within 3 years, you had to recertify by the standards developed by this small group. Hopefully, they could get that done in 3 years to come up with the standards.
That sounds fair enough. Yeah.
And, you know, the members of the education board would be the national coordinator, just to coordinate things, the medical officer, because medical's kind of unique, the training officer, because training is, you know, training coordinator is, you know, it's all training, and then two other people who are not regional coordinators, but outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was their job, and they would meet a couple times a year to develop the curriculum, or, you know, make sure that the curriculum got developed. And so we said, okay, we'll do that. So I went up to the Sault Ste. Marie Convention in 87 and got the coordinators together, and everybody said, oh, this is a great idea. And I said, okay, by this fall, I want each regional coordinator to come up with 3 names of people that will become certified instructors.
Let's branch this out.
Yeah, well, to get and from those we will select the ones we're gonna consider. It doesn't automatically mean they're certified, but we're gonna vote and say, okay, these people will be certified instructors. And one of the criteria is you have had to have taught at a national week-long seminar. Chuck Hempel had been doing a lot of orientations to cave rescue. He really kind of set the standard for what we're doing now. Okay, I mean, he was teaching them long before anybody else. The Central Region kind of copied his format and the way we teach, but But Chuck had been doing this for years, and a lot of fire departments and that kind of thing. And he had kind of a following. It was almost like a click coming through there, you know. And we met, and, you know, people had three names, you know, and so we had this name. Chuck comes up 26 people.
Overachieving.
I think. Well, it's all the people that have been teaching at the weekends for him.
Fair enough.
None of them had taught at a week long. Okay, the only person that, I think the only person in his region that had taught at a week long was Chuck, because I know he'd been at Carlsbad in 85. But we hammered it out, and we came up with our grandfathered certified instructors. One of his guys, and I'm not going to mention names, but he's a good guy. I mean, he's a ropes technician. He's a communication expert. Very intelligent guy. He never taught at a week-long seminar. So we said no, and his ego was bruised. And, I mean, he went to the Board of Governors, accused us of having secret meetings, which you couldn't do as a 501c3 type of organization, and basically for 3 years made our lives hell complaining about this. And so it kind of set us back a little bit because we had to fight this.
Yeah, I guess so.
But anyway, we got through it. And by about 1991, we were well on our way to doing this. And the Ed Board was functioning, and we were getting curriculum out, and things were starting to go really well.
Yeah.
And about 92, I was burnt out.
Yeah, I would imagine that's a lot.
Because you got to realize something. Here's the thing. We didn't have email. We didn't have texting.
No.
We didn't have cell phones. We had to pay for long-distance calls and use a typewriter.
Oh, okay? For heaven's sake.
So those jobs were time-consuming, and I was having to do things like argue with some guy in Nebraska who wanted to be a cave rescue expert so he could wear the patch.
For heaven's
which
sake.
We didn't have. And he never understood that first you got to have caves.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know? Not a lot of those in Nebraska.
And that kind of thing. And I was just fried. And so I think it was the 92 convention, 91 or 92. I told Hudson, I said, "You want to be national coordinator for a while? I'm going to go back to be regional coordinator."
So this trajectory of getting it all figured out. I mean, amidst this, you're doing rescues.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're doing a lot of seek and finds.
Yeah.
A lot of in Buckner's and that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
all the party cavers.
The party cavers and people out of light, people overdue, and, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning phone calls, and go up and go find them and get them out and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So that was the vast majority of the rescues. A, Buckner's. Yeah, B, just seek and find,
seek
and they're fine.
And
but
that kind of thing.
Just get them out.
Get them out, yeah.
What were some of the more complicated ones? I know a few stories, but...
Well, one of them was the guy that fell in the volcano and broke his back in Buckner's. That was... I can make a few corrections on Dick's story.
Okay.
On that one.
If you heard Dick's episode of the podcast, may he rest in peace, he shared a little bit of it.
Yeah. Dick gave me a call. Dick called me up. I think it was a 5:36 o'clock on a Sunday morning,
and
I got out there, and he told me, you know, these guys had come out and said they're, you know, they'd found somebody in there that had gotten hurt, and I found these guys sleeping in their car, and I said, he's in there, he'll be out pretty soon. That was their answer.
They had taken the light. They were basically playing a prank.
This guy had drunk a massive amount of alcohol, probably beer, I'm not sure, but he walked off of the high side of the volcano. And
that's a big fall.
Fell and landed and broke his L5, L7 vertebrae. And he had no feeling in his legs. And Joellen was with me. And so we just took off into the cave. And I took a sked and a KED because we didn't have the OSS then. But I had a KED and I modified it with a piece of plywood for the shoulder board on it. And he was laying there. And he was trying to set up, and he'd set up, and then he'd lay back down, and he'd set up, and when he sat up once, Joellen threw up some packaging material under his back so he could lay down and be warm, and the two of us got him into the KED and into the sked, then started moving him out, and people started showing up and coming in, and we knew we were going to have some issues with the entrance of the crawlway.
Right.
So Dick,
at that time, it was a bit more of a right angle.
It was basically... almost like a Z bend. I mean, it was down. You had to bend and bend to get through. And Dick had got some people to come out with an air compressor and start breaking things up. We got him down, and Noel Sloan, who was our medical officer at the time, and he was our doctor on scene. And we had gotten him to the T.
At that point, I mean, it's pretty technical just to get him there, to get him, A, out of the volcano room. That's tight.
Yeah.
And then down below, that's not so bad. But then around through the breakdown, through the creek and whatnot, my gosh.
Yeah, well, we slid him out the right side entrance, and he went down there pretty easily. And then Noel had come in with a split furno, and you could get a split furno in to the cave because it was in two pieces.
Yeah.
And then once we got that, we put it together, and then we just picked up the skid and set it in the furno, which made it a lot easier to handle. And we got him around to the T. Dean Meyer had come down from Indianapolis and ran phones, and he had a phone coming back to the T. We got on the phone, and I said, how long before we can get out? And they said 20 minutes. Well, in the meantime, Noel wanted to consult with one of his colleagues at Methodist.
Methodist Hospital, Indianapolis.
Methodist Hospital, Indianapolis. So we're on the set, we're on the field phones, and Dwight Hazen is operating a phone patch outside where he would, when Noel would talk, he would key the radio, and the radio would go through a repeater, the Bloomington repeater, and we auto patch from that into the hospital in Bloomington.
Wow.
And the hospital in Bloomington patched their phone system to Methodist. And so Noel's on the phone.
This is 1984,
83? Yeah, somewhere.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Early, mid-80s.
That area, yeah, the mid-80s. I need to look that up because I've had people asking me about it, and I've got some records of it somewhere in a file cabinet. So Noel, he's talking to this guy, and the guy says, Noel, where are you? And Noel says, I'm 600 feet back, down a crawlway in Buckner's Cave in Monroe County. And the neurosurgeon says, Noel, where are you really?
I'm telling the truth, man.
Yeah. And so anyway, they consulted for a while, and they pretty much decided not to give him I think it was an anti-swelling drug because it had to be an IV.
Oh.
And they didn't really want to start the IV if they didn't have to in the cave. And so they just put it on hold. So anyway, then they came back, and I said, how much longer? And they said, 20 minutes. I said, okay, let's start easing our way to the entrance and just take our time, and by the time we get there, we'll pop out.
What was the condition of the patient at this point? Was he worried? Was he anxious? Was he in pain? Was not a lot of thought put into that? You just got to get him out?
We just got to get him out, and he didn't complain a lot. He just kind of laid there in the stretcher.
Yeah.
I mean, he was conscious, and he wasn't joking around or anything. I mean,
no.
he was, but he wasn't complaining. He wasn't moaning or groaning or anything.
Yeah.
He was just there. And so anyway, we get up to the entrance of the little chute crawlway to come out, a 15, 20 footer, and we're kind of all sitting around there. And I said, how long? They said, 20 minutes.
You said that 20 minutes enough.
So we played the 20-minute game for 2.5 hours.
Oh, my God.
Now, we could have been back at the tee.
Yeah.
I considered a couple of times of just going back, but I didn't really want to, you know. But, you know, we could hear the jackhammering out there and the whole bit. So anyway, I finally went out through the crawlway and got up to see what was going on. And I said, okay, you guys will, 20 minutes might be accurate. Went back down, and pretty soon we tried it. And I tried to get him out in the furno. Didn't work.
Ah.
So we had to pull him back. And that can be demoralizing.
I can imagine.
For the guy.
You've already been waiting 2 hours.
2 hours, and we're going to... It wasn't far, but we had to pull him back, take the sked out, and then take him out in the sked, which he did.
That worked.
And that worked, and we got him, and then we brought the furno out, put it back together, and then used the furno to and we basically just set up a litter pass of people to the entrance and got him out. And the neurosurgeon said later, I don't know how you guys did it, but normally with this injury, they lose bowel and bladder control.
Really?
He's paraplegic for life,
right.
But he maintained bowel and bladder control.
Oh, my word.
We felt pretty good about that. We didn't find that out until later, after, you know, the surgeries and the treatments or whatever they did. But that was what we were told later. And I never followed up on it to find out.
Wow. But,
another side was, we're walking up the hill, and a state cop comes up to me, and he says, honest to God, we just put in a $45,000 communication system, and we can't touch what you guys can do. I said, Cavers.
Oh, that's right, Cavers.
Yeah. Yeah, he was pretty impressed with what we did talking to Methodist men there. So,
well, there's your validation right there. Right, there's your certification.
Yeah. So anyhow, but the funny thing was, we all went to my house afterwards, and the only thing we did, instead of saying, "Man, we pulled off one of the toughest, you know, rescues we had."
Yeah.
We're all sitting there bummed out, going, "Well, how are we going to handle a lawsuit?" And we were really concerned.
I can only imagine.
You know, because. Evidently, the guy had worked at Z-Bart, didn't really have any insurance, and you know, he was young, and so anyhow, that was
had a family too.
Yeah, but never heard much about it. So that was a big one. Wayne's Cave was a big one.
Yeah. Wayne's got the long crawlway, and so how the heck did you do that? This was Camp 2 where this happened?
No, just past Camp 1.
Oh, just past Camp 1 where the guy got hurt.
You get out of the crawlway, and there's a place where you got to climb up.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of a technical climb to get up. It's maybe 20, 30 feet, something like that, and then over the passage. And down. He fell from the top of that and broke the fall with his face. And honest, I was not there. Believe it or not, I was in Missouri at the Cave Management Symposium giving a paper on the National Cave Rescue Commission. I came home, and my answering machine, and I had one of these cassette tape answering machines.
Yeah.
The tape was gone. I mean, it was completely filled up with calls and calls and calls and calls and calls. But I asked Noel Sloan, I said, how bad was he hurt? And Noel said, well, let me put it this way. He probably bought some plastic surgeon a new Mercedes.
Oh, my word.
But they did it. And we had talked about Wayne's. And said, how are we going to do this?
How the heck would we do that?
And we knew stalactite squeeze would be gone.
Right.
And
at that time, it was a lot more of a squeeze.
Oh, I'd seen grown men cry in that thing. I mean, it was tight.
Wow.
And not long, but tight for just a pop through.
So that had to be kind of trenched, or did you have to scrape off the ceiling? How'd that go?
They went in, took out the stalactite. There was a column. It's called stalactite squeeze. There was a column. I think it was about 8 inches.
Hmm.
And they hammered that out and then busted up the flowstone floor. It was a flowstone floor.
Okay.
And busted
gotcha.
All that out and cleaned it up. So
yikes.
Yeah.
Man.
But anyhow, that was actually the first big one that happened. And then the next one was Aaron Howell, the King Blair.
I'm not familiar with this one.
Okay. This happened in 92. When was the Salem Convention?
92. Yeah.
92. Okay. It happened in 92 because it was one of the fortunate things. One phone call. Got the world. It was a Sunday night. I had been down in Donahue's with Bill Reniker, who was the NCRC training officer at the time. He was from Fox Lake, Illinois. He was a paramedic instructor. He wasn't really a caver. I mean, he didn't go to Cave Capers, you know, conventions. He didn't go caving except at NCRC. He was an agency guy. Okay?
Right. Okay.
But anyhow, he would come down. He would go caving with me. I'd take him caving. Sometimes just the two of us, and we went down, and he was getting into search dogs, and so we went into Donahue to play with Resar, his search dog, play hide and seek. So we were in Donahue's all afternoon Sunday, running around. I was hiding, and Resar was finding me, and he was calling Resar off, and I go, hi, Bill, you know, and kind of learning some search dog and cave techniques, and came back, and we went to a restaurant, and it was Bill and his wife. And we decided to have dinner Sunday night at a restaurant in the west east side of Bloomington. And they were going to stay all night in the hotel and then boogie on back to northern Illinois the next day. And right when our food came, I had a pager at the time.
Yeah.
A pager went off, and so I called Dick, and Dick said, this is the one we've been waiting for.
Oh.
Or what? And he says, I just heard that somebody fell at the climb down from Brenninger's to King Blair and has a severe head injury. And I go, oh, my goodness, we got a problem. So I came back and I said, well, Bill, you want to go on a real rescue? He'd never been on a real rescue. He said, yeah, sure. I said, let's go. So we took off, and he went back to the hotel, dropped off his wife, and I said, come on and meet me at my house. I'm going to go get the cash, because I had the cash, Central Region cash, and was in my garage, and threw it all in the back of the truck and drove out. And Scott Fee had an apartment, I think, in Greenwood at the time, and he was chairman of the convention, and they were having a convention meeting. And I wasn't there because I was running the NCRC week-long the week before in Milltown. So I wasn't involved with any of the convention work. And so that's why I wasn't at the meeting. And one phone call had the world.
Oh, wow. You know,
so we got everybody moving. Although people have been caving all day Sunday, and here it is Sunday night. We got everybody together, and I wanted to make sure that I had oxygen going in because I had a head injury, and I had Bloomington Hospital emergency people come out, and they were really reluctant to even want to go in the cave.
Really?
Well, King Blair's pretty nasty.
I've not been in there, so I yeah.
It's gnarly. It's a lot of crawling in water and climbing over breakdown in water and wet and nasty and gnarly and he was.
So you had a job ahead of you.
I had a job ahead of me. We had done in '87 an OCR at the Monroe County Fairgrounds. And we used King Blair for the mock.
Really?
And the mock failed. We couldn't do it.
Huh.
And the main reason was we didn't have enough people. And I knew right then that with this one, we were going to need the world.
All hands on deck.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it was even calling Cincinnati and calling Louisville and getting people on standby because we thought we might need them. Mm. Even called Chicago, I think. Said, you know, we might need you. We don't know yet.
Wow.
And got down and sent people in. Now, this guy's 1,300 feet from the entrance. We start moving him about 8 o'clock Sunday night. We get him to the entrance at 7 o'clock Monday morning.
Oh, my God.
I had at one time 68 people in the cave. Had 120-some show up.
Started moving him. How long? I mean, was he conscious? Was he unconscious?
He was conscious, okay. But he was a little bit whacked out.
Yeah. So you started moving him at 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I think I was around 8 o'clock when he finally started moving him.
Okay, and how long had he been there after the injury?
3 o'clock in the afternoon.
3 o'clock in the afternoon. You're there 5 hours later.
Yeah.
Start moving him.
Yeah.
And then it takes 11 hours to get, wow.
Yeah, and Frank Lamb's one of the most street smart paramedics I ever met. Because at one time he says, I'm not going to make it, I'm not going to make it. And Frank just grabbed him by the collar of his shirt or whatever and picked him up and said, look, we got 130 people here to get you out. You're not going to let them down. And he said, okay.
Wow.
Just what he needed. You know. But there was some hairy stuff in here. I guess Mark Webb, actually, there was a time when they needed some paving to get the litter across in a stream, and Mark basically held his breath and stuck his face in the water and just stayed underwater until they got the litter across his back.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so that's kind of stuff that was going on during this rescue.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's like heroic.
Yeah, and we got him out. And
yeah.
He had a lacerated liver, I think.
Oh, my word.
I'm not sure. HIPAA stuff, I don't know what I'm supposed to say or can't say, but I think he wound up with surgery.
Yeah.
Emergency surgery that Monday night because of some damage, but he survived. Because he was out a couple years later on a search. This is paybacks for hell, buddy.
So he kept caving after that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Didn't stop
Yeah,
him.
I don't know if he's still caving or not. I haven't seen him in years, so I don't know. But
man.
But he did, yeah.
You guys did it.
We pulled it off. And on that one, I remember I basically had headquarters right in front of Dick's house working out of my truck because I managed the operations for the thing. That particular rescue, I remember the euphoria that hit me when I got the radio message, he's out. And if that's the kind of high that people get on drugs, I can understand.
You get it.
Drug addiction. It was something I'd never felt before. It was really, really strange.
Man.
But I went down, and I'd been on the phone with the Van Buren Volunteer Fire Department, saying, we need some help. Mm. I got a bunch of wiped out people. We're getting him out of the cave. We need some people down here to carry him up the hill. Because the entrance to King Blair is down in Blair Springs. And it was nasty and muddy and bad, you know, hiking. they said, well, you guys got him out. You guys bring him up the hill. And I said, no. Our job was to get him out of the cave. It's your patient. Well, we're not going to do this. I said, yeah, you are.
Yeah, he's out. He's
gonna,
under.
Well, he wasn't out yet, but he was going to be out. And I said he's going to be out at about 7 o'clock. And I said, you guys need to be here to haul him up the hill because my people can't do it.
Yeah.
And because Kevin Komisarsik, who was running underground at that point in time, he called me and he says, we're wiped.
Man.
And so anyway, I remember I walked out to congratulate people coming up the hill, and it was like Night of the Living Dead. And I was going, way to go, and they were just crashing into me. Blah, blah.
So you talk about the feeling that you got when you heard he was out. Have you ever had that feeling that strongly in another rescue?
No.
No?
No.
That was it.
That was a tough one there. It was, because I thought we were going to lose him.
Man.
I really thought we might lose this guy. And plus being super tired. You know, caving all day and been up all night. And really, you know, one of my weaknesses I'm discovering now at my late age is I can get extremely focused and just really focus on what I'm doing. And I get mistaken the wrong way by other people. This guy is really a butthole. But I'm focused on what I'm doing and really hard. And sometimes my interpersonal relationships kind of drift off at that point, how I act interpersonally with people. And it's not intentional. It's just, you know, I'm focused on that, and I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings, but I'm focused on this. And,
right.
And I don't have time to play games, you know. And that may be a little bit of submarine training on that, too, because, you know, you focused on what you're doing.
Get the job done.
You get it done, yeah. But, yeah, that was quite a rescue.
Anything else you wanted to make sure we talked about?
Well, I'll give you another rescue.
Oh, let's do it. That's what I wanted to hear.
This is Freeman's. Freeman's Pit, 1985.
Yeah.
Get a call from Dick. Somebody's hung up somewhere in a cave over by Whitehall. They're going to give me directions on how to get there. If they'd have said Freeman's Pit, I'd have went there, but nobody knew it was Freeman's Pit.
Right.
So I get over there, and I drive down, and my car at the time is a Volkswagen diesel pickup truck.
I got to admit, I didn't even know they made them.
Yeah, they made them, okay. 4-speed Volkswagen diesel pickup truck. It was 1985.
Wow.
And I know it was 85 because I think it was like right after the Roman Osowski rescue. I get there and they said, in here, and I turn in and drive down. I said, this is Freeman's. And I drive right up to the entrance of the pit. Mm-hmm. So I got the gate down and a road open. And I get down there and I look in and they got a 3/8 manila rope rigged off a tree going across the big sinkhole. And I hadn't been to Freeman's in years. And I didn't know the big sinkhole was like that and you know, like it was. But anyway, going across to a guy who's two kids, and I think they might be related to the owners. And I haven't followed up on this one yet. And they're probably in their 40s now anyway.
Yeah.
They decided to free climb the back wall down to the pit, down in the cave. One of them was at the top, and the other one was about 20 feet down, stuck in back in an alcove.
Oh, my word.
They had the 3/8 manila rope. He had tied that around his waist.
So just in case.
So basically, if he fell, if he'd fallen, it would have snapped that rope. He'd have shock-loaded it, and he'd have went to the bottom. And the other guy was at the top. And so I rigged a rope, took a rope with me, had a full harness, webbing, extra stuff. And rappelled down, just down across the sinkhole. And then the sinkhole comes around, and then there's a narrow neck. And then it goes out over the pit. And I was sitting on the neck, over the pit. My legs are over the pit. But I'm sitting there, and I'm secure. And I'm going, now what? Okay, got to get this guy out.
Yeah.
And so I throw him a line. And I said, he's kind of sitting stable. I think he's straddling the formation. I'm not sure. But anyway, he was stable. I said, don't move. If you can't catch this, let it go. I'll get it to you. And I threw him a line, and he caught it. And so he's holding that. And I tied up a sling and a carabiner and sent it over to him on the rope and had him put on a Swiss seat, took the figure eight that I tied in the end of the rope, clicked it into the carabiner. So now we had him secured. And I said, okay. And Kevin Komisarsik and Sam Frischauer and Steve Clark had shown up. And I said, okay, you guys, and I had rigged a progress capture gibbous ender on a tree so that when we did this, they'd have progress capture on a straight haul.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, kid, climb to me. Come back over to me. And so they belayed him, and I belayed him, and he worked his way around and got to me, went over me, and went on out of the cave. He was fine. Okay.
Good deal.
Good deal. So the other guy, the junior, sitting over there. And I pull up the main rope. My rack is on the main rope.
Mm-hmm.
I pull it up, and I throw it to him. And he catches it. I had him take the 3/8 manila off, and they pulled it out of the way. And I said, okay. I think his mom was up there, and I said, what's his waist size? He gave it to me, and I tied up a Swiss seat real quick, put a carabiner on it, slid it down to him, and I said, okay, put this on. Well, he'd stand up and lean over the pit to put this on. Sit down, kid.
Oh, my
I'm
God.
I'm shouting at him. And he finally gets it on, and he gets the carabiner locked, and he gets the rope on it, and I pull up all the slack. Okay, so I've got the slack here, and I've got all the whole rappel, 150-foot rope that I've got there. And he's there, and I pull it up, and I said, okay, kid, hold on to the rope with both hands. Whatever you do, do not let go with your hands and jump.
Oh, my God.
And he goes, no. And I said, you'll be fine. All I need you to do is just slide off the ledge. I'll catch you. No, I'll fall like the other guy. The other guy kind of slipped when he went out, and I said, you'll be fine. And I'm getting ready to just yank him off the ledge, and I look down, and all of a sudden I notice that he's going to come out like this. He's going to be below me. Mm-hmm. The rack is going over my top of my leg.
Oh.
And I'm sitting here like this.
Oh.
And I go, oh, man.
Oh, wait.
Glad I caught this. And I pulled my left foot up, and just when I got it up enough to where I could slide it out, he launched.
Oh, oh God.
So he launches, bam, I caught him, and he's swinging below me, bam, tight on this leg. The leg is pinned against the pit, and I'm sitting there going, now what?
Oh, no.
So anyway, what I managed to do is I just managed to take my foot and slipped it off, and when I did, he pendulum out. So he's dropped between my legs.
Yeah.
And he's screaming, pull me up, pull me up, pull me up. And I said, hang on. And I lowered him all the way to the bottom.
Okay.
Because now the angles are right.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I went over and I rappelled down to him, put him in my sit harness. I had him send down a hard hat.
Okay.
So we got him in a hard hat and a sit harness, hooked up the haul line to him, and they hauled him out of the cave.
Oh, terrific.
And then I climbed out and just derigged everything and went home. But that's one that really quite a deal. So
yeah.
What was the one that
you've talked about a lot? Are you talking about the one that happened at Springmill?
Springmill, yeah, Roman.
Yeah. So yeah. You touch on that briefly. So that was a rescue that then was reenacted on Rescue 911.
Yeah, they did a Rescue 911 on it, and I took a lot of crap from the caving community over doing that 911 thing. But the reason why we did it was the fact that that rescue was a pivot point for Indiana caving in our relationship with DNR
yeah.
and state parks.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to upset the apple cart because we were at a pretty delicate balance there. We were being accepted for the first time by DNR. And Billy Carlisle called me personally and said, okay, they're going to do this. Don't leave me hanging. I need help. And I said, okay, we'll see what we can do to help.
You were featured on the program. You were on the episode.
I got interviewed at home for 3 hours for the 11-minute segment. and they shot 480 minutes of video on that and edited it down to 11 minutes. And it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
We use it in training now as what not to do.
Mm.
As I said, but you know, we did a lot of stupid stuff back then. You know, we're still learning. And,
Some of the stuff, if I remember correctly, some of the stuff that you did that you consider stupid, you kind of at the time considered stupid. But at the time, people were demanding action.
Yeah.
You know, people, yeah. And so you guys came up with the plan to go into the other entrance yeah. with a raft, and yeah. it was high water, and so that was a bad idea, yeah. but you kind of knew that was a bad idea at the time.
Yeah, but we didn't know it was bad it was going to get.
You didn't know it was that bad.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, so but it was, long story short, this yeah. guy and his buddy went in with a flashlight, right. water came up, the buddy got washed out, he was still in there, the buddy ran for help, and he was in there for a couple of days?
56 hours.
56 hours.
Yeah.
And got him out, and he was fine. It was summertime.
Yeah.
The air in the cave was warm enough.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Didn't have hypothermia.
Right.
It was on a tiny little ledge, yeah. mere feet from the exit.
Yeah, wearing a pair of swim trunks and one tennis shoe.
Oh, that's just insane. Everybody's worried about him.
Yeah.
And it was a happy ending, thank
exactly.
God.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. God, I feel like I could do a two-parter with you, three-, four-parter.
Well, when you've been around 50 years, I mean, doing a lot of stuff, it's there. And I did a little stuff as EVP. And I think the big thing I did as executive vice president was getting the endowment fund set up for international exploration.
Oh, yeah. All right. And, so, yeah, you were executive vice president of the NSS.
Yeah. And I was EVP when we bought Great X.
Great Expectations. All right.
Yeah. And I remember going to the meeting and we got slammed with it. I didn't even know it was coming. At the time, and they hit up the board to buy Grade X, and it was going to be a lot of money. The thing is the NSS has a nasty habit of spending money they don't have for stuff. And my first board meeting, I was 19 years old, and that was when the executive committee came in and told the board of directors, "Hey, we just." Made a deal to buy Shelta Cave from Nature Conservancy for $35,000. We need some money.
Oh.
And they made the deal without the director's approval.
And my God.
That was cool. I mean, one of the things I got to do for that meeting, my job at the meeting, I had to go to the O'Hare Airport and pick up Bill Stevenson, the founder of the NSS.
Right on.
And drive him into the meeting. I was with him alone for 30 minutes, and did I get a lecture? Did I get a lecture? I mean, it was the whole future of the NSS is in my hands. You know, it's like Smokey Bear and me in forest fires. You know,
oh
only you.
God.
You know, but he was a neat guy. He was a neat guy, and he was very, very congenial. And I knew that, you know, when they did that, and it was probably a done deal because I think some backdoor politics are going on. But they bought Great X and appropriated the money. Prior to that, the funding for international exploration grants came from the NSS auction at convention.
Wow. That's not a lot of cash, is it?
Right. And I knew that was gone. The till was dry on that. But Joe Ivey, who was an NCRC instructor at the time, had died in an accident in 09 well down in Texas.
Mm.
And there was the Joe Ivey Fund, where people had created a lot of money. And that money was going to be given to, because he was a big expedition caver, that was going to go to doing expedition caving. And I said, that's not quite enough. But I went to the NSS Treasury and said, can we find some more money and set up a fund, an endowment fund, similar to the Sarah Corey Fund that is used for domestic U.S. exploration,
mm-hmm.
set up an endowment for international exploration, because we didn't have enough in the Joe Ivey Fund to do that. And I talked to Becky, and she said, yeah, she'd be ready to go on it. And Dave Ehring said, yeah, we've got this thing from the last International Congress that it's just sitting there making money, and we haven't done anything with it. We could probably get some money from that. And the only person that really was really against it was John Moses, who was director of that fund. He just didn't want anybody tapping his till. And I said, look, make it a loan. We'll eventually pay it back or something, but we need to do this. And so we did and started that International Exploration Endowment.
Huh.
And it started out small.
Which went on to fund what?
It gets the grants for international exploration grants.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where that money comes from now. And then Ron Simmons died in an accident and had willed a bunch of money to that fund.
Mm.
So it's worth a lot now.
So now
and Joel Despain is the guy that handles, you know, the disbursements on that and has been for years.
Yeah.
But that was probably the best thing I did as EVP.
Have you been on international expeditions at all?
No, I've caved internationally, but I haven't been on any expedition. I'm not much of an expedition caver except for James.
Huh.
And James is my baby.
James Cave,
James
Kentucky.
Cave, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that for another hour or two.
I got to go down there to James with you guys some weekend. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's addictive. Sarah Corey said it says you'll love it or hate it. No in between.
Well, Don, this has been great.
It's been fun.
This has been awesome. I really appreciate it. And thanks for all you've done for Cave Rescue and the NSS and everything else. And, hell, maybe I'll have you back. We'll talk about James Cave.
Okay, we'll do that.
Oh, man. James Cave. Maybe another show, huh? Thank you, Don Paquette. And thank you for listening. This is a monthly podcast about caving, so we're back on December 1st with Canadian expedition caver Christian Stenner, who has done a lot of work in glacier caves and steam caves, as well as caves in very remote parts of Canada for scientific research. It's going to be a big episode, very exciting stuff, and I can't wait for you to hear it. As always, support the podcast by supporting our sponsors, past and present, Organic Robot on Etsy with very fun caving and outdoor-related apparel featuring unique original designs available on moisture-wicking fabrics, Organic Robot on Etsy, and of course, the best caving packs out there, Swago. Visit swagogear.com. You can also support the podcast directly on Patreon at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. Listen, if everyone who listened monthly gave a one-time donation of $1, boy, I'd have more than $1,000 that would go right back into cave conservation. That's my promise to you if you support the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/cavingpodcast. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.